You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you back the wake of Thanksgiving. Actually, today has a special name for the day. It's Evacuation Day. No, it's not brought to you by Ex-Lax. It is a... Today is the day that the British evacuated New York back in 1783, November 25th, 1783, and Alexander Hamilton commemorated it as Evacuation Day, the blessed end of 7 years of British rule and martial law, end of quote from Alexander Hamilton. The day kind of faded out, though. It got replaced by Thanksgiving, but... Anyhow, today, happy Evacuation Day, for what it's worth. a lot going on today in the news. Of course, Vermont is still proceeding with their single-payer healthcare system. Looks like this is going to be an epic thing. I am back from my book tour a week from tomorrow. Not tomorrow. I think last week I had been saying tomorrow, but a week from tomorrow. On December, what would that be, the 3rd, I think? December 3, a week from tomorrow, I will be at Politics and Prose here in Washington, D.C., the bookstore, signing books. So those of you in the D.C. area, we will have great fun. We're going to have a good time. Paul Krugman has an interesting blog in the New York Times today, California, Here We Come, about how well Obamacare is actually working in California. Very interesting. The numbers, he says, are increasingly encouraging. And the same thing in Kentucky. There was another blog over, I think it was at Democratic Underground, about how, you know, I'm reluctant to put on labels, so I'll just give you the details. You know, a white guy making around 18 grand a year with a couple of kids in Kentucky walks in and says, this Obamacare thing, can I get something? I got no insurance, right? Well, yes, sir. Not only do you get it, but you get it for free because you're eligible for Medicaid. Because Kentucky took the Medicaid money and their governor set up an exchange. Even though this is, this is Mitch McConnell territory, right? And the guy's going, that's interesting. You know, I think I just became a Democrat. This is what the Republicans are so afraid of. I mean, this is what they are plain old flat out terrified by. There's no other way to describe it than just, you know, plain old terror. Here he is. His name was Ronald Hudson. He was 35 years old. He never had insurance. He says his hospital bills were 23 grand at that point. He had five kids, made $14,000 before taxes. He says, well, thank God, I believe I'm going to be a Democrat. And this is in an area where Romney took 66% of the vote. Obama only took 31% of the vote. Interesting post about this by Marcos Melitzis over at the Daily Kos. So do you get it? I mean, this is as much as I was first in line, I guess, to say, you know, Obamacare, it's just Romney care. It's Heritage Foundation care. It's a program that keeps intact the health insurance companies, but Bernie Sanders and Ron Wyden put this thing into it that said starting in 2016, if a state wants to go single payer, they can, and they are. So we have Vermont going single payer in 2017, January 2017, or at the end of 2016. And in the meantime, you've got states, those states where the Republicans decided, or where the legislatures and the governors decided to take the Medicaid expansion and set up their own exchanges, things are going quite well. Now, I've said this a couple of times, but I think I probably should repeat it at least once a day, if not once an hour, forever, until the Democrats here in Washington, D.C. figure this thing out and start doing something about it. Bobby Jindal down in Louisiana, Rick Scott down in Louisiana, Rick Snyder up in Michigan, Scott Walker in Wisconsin. Hey, you guys. Whatever happened to Ronald Reagan saying, it's your money, about tax dollars? In your states, and you, the, of course, they're not alone. I mean, it's 30-plus states now, I believe. In these states with these Republican governors, they are perfectly happy to let the federal government take the tax money from the citizens of their state and bring that money to Washington, D.C. But then when Washington, D.C. says, here, we'll give this tax money back to your citizens in Ohio and Wisconsin and Florida and Louisiana and Alabama and Mississippi and in Tennessee, we would be glad to give that money back to your citizens. The money that they themselves paid, that you paid, that tax money. Now, the Koch brothers might have paid a little more of it than the average guy who's making $6,000 a year, which might have something to do with why the Koch brothers are sponsoring keggers to get young people to not sign up for Obamacare to try and blow the system up. But the fact of the matter is that federal tax dollars came from these states, went to Washington, D.C., and Washington, D.C. is now saying to these states, hey, you want your tax dollars back? We'll give it to you in the form of Medicaid. We'll give it to you in the form of free health insurance for people who are making up to 132% of poverty. Or 147 or whatever, roughly 1.5 times the rate of poverty. It's free. And you've got these governors saying, no, we're not going to take it. And they're using this excuse like, oh, that would make us dependent on the government. It's your money! It was your tax dollars to begin with, people! Your governor and your Republican state legislators, your Republican governor and your Republican state legislators, now there are a few exceptions. Jan Brewer in Arizona, she said, yeah, we'll take our money back. I think there might be one other exception, one other Democrat or one other Republican who's taken their money back. But this needs to be the mantra. I mean, the Democrats need to be designing campaign ads right now for the 2014 election in those states that do not take Medicaid money back from the federal government. They need to say, citizens of Florida, taxpayers of Florida, you paid federal taxes. Your money went to the federal government. The federal government wants to give your money back to you in the form of free health insurance. But Rick Scott says he doesn't want to take that money because he's trying to hurt the Democrats. He's trying to make it look bad for Obama. He thinks if he doesn't take that money and you don't have health insurance, that you'll be upset with Obama. Do you get this, people who live in Florida? Do you get this, people who live in Louisiana? Do you get this, Alabamians? Do you get this, people who live in Mississippi? Do you get this, Texans? Rick Perry doesn't want you to have your money. Your tax dollars, the money that you sent to Washington, D.C. in the form of federal taxes, Rick Perry doesn't want you to get that back in the form of free health care. So if you don't, you know, if you're making Walmart wages, if you're making just, you know, if you're making under the poverty level or under 130 or so percent of the poverty level, sorry, you don't get health insurance. Because Rick Perry said, yeah, they paid taxes, but no, they can't have the money back. I'm serious. And this, I mean, think about it for a minute. That's what these Republican governors, that's what Rick Perry and Rick Scott and Scott Walker and Rick Snyder are saying. Now, John Kasich, he said, okay, we'll take the money. Jan Brewer, okay, we'll take the money. As far as I know, they're the only two Republicans. There might have been another one or two. Oh, Chris Christie, yeah, he said, I'll take the money too. See, he's no dummy. He's going to run for president. Can you see Scott Walker running for president on the campaign, on the platform of, yeah, we don't want to take that federal money that we paid the federal government. No.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I mean, how does he think he's going to win? I don't know. 15 minutes past the hour. By the way, I wanted to talk about death with dignity. I'll be right back with that. Andrew Campbell on the line with us, the senior producer over at The Big Picture. Hey, our TV program that goes on at 7 o'clock tonight on Free Speech TV Network and the RT Network. Hey, Andrew, how you doing?
Good, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So we're going to start out with a little bit of a rant, and then Dr. Trita Parsi, former Congressman Bob Ney, et cetera.
Yeah, we're still looking for some guests to talk about the latest developments coming out of Iran. As everyone knows by now, basically an agreement's been made that would really curtail any potential nuclear threat from Iran.
Mm-hmm.
It was reached on Saturday in Geneva. And we're going to touch on really talk about Iranian culture, really debunk some of the myths that the West has about Iran, and really discuss really how this deal will play out.
Right.
And we'll get into sort of all the nitty gritty about this. It's really a historic thing.
It really and truly is, and it's an extraordinary opportunity and opening, and. I'm very much looking forward to that conversation. Okay, in our second block, we're going to get into maximum pay for the rich or minimum pay for everybody else or what?
Yeah, we're going to be talking about maximum pay for the rich with Richard Wolff. He's always great to get on, great economist, really knows what's going on in the world. Switzerland just did this. It was a public referendum held this weekend, which would have basically maxed out corporate executive pay. Unfortunately, it was defeated.
Well, they had another one about 7 months ago that actually won.
Yeah.
It did not go this far.
No.
This was the 13-1, was it? Wasn't it?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah. And the other one was just that in order for an executive to get that kind of pay, A, it had to be transparent, and B, it had to be board approved rather
right.
than just committee approved and all
Correct.
That kind of thing.
Then we're gonna move on from that one Swiss story to another. We're going to talk to Ino Schmidt, who is a German artist, but he's actually behind a huge push in Switzerland right now to give a basic income to all citizens, regardless of whether you're employed, unemployed, rich, poor, lazy, hardworking. It's really an interesting idea. Obviously, it has its critics, but it's going to be a very interesting discussion to get into.
I agree. I think it's going to be fascinating. In Block C, do companies have the right to murder?
Yeah, it's been about a year since the devastating factory fire in Bangladesh. And immediately after that, there were strong calls for the companies that had garment factories in the facility to help the victims of the tragedy and to really fix working conditions, et cetera. But a year later, these companies are refusing to really take any action. We're going to bring on Horace Cooper for a debate and just talk about, do corporations have the right to murder their workers? I mean, it's really the only way to put it. It's a tragedy that this happened, and there should be improvements, but these multi-billion-dollar corporations are refusing to make them.
Yeah, yeah. It's rather breathtaking. Everything you know is wrong?
Everything you know is wrong. We're going to be talking to Bob Rimmel of Rimmel Greenhouses, and really talk about how easy it is to go organic and live a sustainable lifestyle. A lot of people think that it's a lot harder and or more expensive to eat organic foods or to look for the top quality organic produce.
Not if you grow it yourself.
Yeah, you can compost right in your backyard and you really live a better life, so we'll get into that.
Yeah, okay. And our daily take about America's biggest welfare queens and... It seems that most of them are corporations.
Yeah, corporate welfare is on the rise, and it's time to stop it.
Indeed. Andrew Campbell. Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks, Tom.
Great seeing you. We'll see you in a few hours. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past it. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Yes, the crash of 2016 is rolling along. I actually got pretty good at giving my speech. And, in fact, I want to share some of the insights from the crash of 2016. It really is a great example of, on the one hand, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Reasonably good people trying to do good things and it blowing up on them. And then creating a space into which genuine predators, and in this case it was Ken Lay and Enron, could step and create a space for other predators, that's the banksters on Wall Street, to make a killing and destroy the country. And we're still in the midst of that. So, but the other thing I wanted to share with you is this letter. This just took my breath away. This is a letter by the guy who does Dilbert. The page. We've got to change our print format so that it always prints headers and footers because I don't have Scott's last name. I know it's on his website. I know it's his URL. Does anybody remember Scott, who does Dilbert, his last name? Adams, Scott Adams. That's right. Thank you. He says, I hope, it's titled, I hope my father dies soon. He says, I hope my father dies soon. And while I'm at it, I might want you to die a painful death too. I'm entirely serious on both counts. And then he goes talking about how his dad is 86 years old. He's nearing death. His mind is mostly gone, and he's in horrible pain. He says, if my dad were a cat, we would have put him to sleep a long time ago, and not once would we have looked back and thought too soon. Thought that it was too soon. He says, instead, it's far too late. He says, I'd like to proactively end his suffering and let him go with some dignity, but my government says I can't make that decision, neither can his doctors, so for all practical purposes, the government is torturing my father until he dies. I'm a patriotic guy by nature. I love my country, but the government, well, we just broke up. And then Scott Adams adds this. He says, now let me say this next part as clearly as I can. If you're a politician who has ever voted against doctor-assisted suicide, or would vote against it in the future, I hate your blanking guts, and I would like you to die a long, horrible death. I would be happy to kill you personally and watch you bleed out. I won't do that because I fear the consequences, but I'd enjoy it because you blank Eckers are responsible for torturing my father. Now it's personal. He talks about how his emotions are a bit raw, and no doubt about it. Washington State and Oregon are the only two states that have death with dignity laws. And we had a number of people on this program when we were broadcasting out of Oregon, and death with dignity was being debated in both Washington State and Oregon ultimately. And then when it passed in Washington State and it was being debated in Oregon, I had physicians on. And the way it works is you have to be within 6 months of dying. Two doctors have to certify that. And your quality of life has to be fairly minimal. And two doctors have to certify that. And they give you a prescription for a little bottle of orange flavored, you know, it's like a little bottle of cough syrup. And basically what it is a massive overdose of, I think it's phenobarbital. It's one of the barbiturate drugs, as I recall. And you drink it, and you go to sleep quietly, and 6-8 hours later, you're dead. And what was most fascinating in my conversations with these physicians about this. And we also got calls from people who actually had these prescriptions sitting on the night table next to them. Was that the number of people who found themselves in these horrible end-of-life situations where their mind was still clear enough that they could think, and under other circumstances they might, you know, if they had a gun they'd blow their brains all over the wall. Or, you know, try to slit their wrists or try other ways to kill themselves that may or may not be effective and may or may not be a lot more painful. Almost always a lot more painful. If not for them, then for everybody around them. And you don't gather your family around and say, hey, everybody, you know, nice to see you. I love you. Hold my hand while I shoot myself in the head. You just don't do it. Was that the people who did use these drugs did so in a way that had dignity, where they literally would gather their family around and say, okay, I'm going to go now. And Johnny, goodbye to you. And Sally, thank you so much for the life. And, you know, whatever. You just, you know, and then glug, glug, glug. And even then, they'd be, you know, awake for a half hour or so before they just kind of fall asleep. But the interesting thing was that the percentage of people who actually killed themselves went down. Because what people would do is they'd say, you know, I'm in terrible pain and I'm dying and I'm terminal, but I'm no longer afraid because there's that bottle just 6 inches from me and all I have to do is drink it. And I can wait another hour. And I can wait another hour after that. And I can wait another hour after that. And they would just keep saying that. You know, I can wait another hour. And more often than not, they died of natural causes rather than drinking the drug. It actually, death with dignity laws actually reduce suicides. For those of you who have a religious objection and think that people who commit suicide go to purgatory or hell or something, death with dignity laws actually reduce suicides. So why don't we do this nationwide? And this isn't, by the way, just for 80 and 90-year-olds. I mean, there are 20 and 30 and 40-year-olds who are in stage 4 cancers. They're racked in pain. They're going to live just a few weeks. Why should they not have the ability to gather their friends and family around and say goodbye and then just drink some orange
You're
juice?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I realize this is sort of the opposite of talking about Obamacare, except in the addled mind of Sarah Palin. But we... By the way, you probably didn't hear in the corporate media, to the best of my knowledge, wasn't part of the Sunday shows, although I was on an airplane much of Sunday yesterday coming home, that last year healthcare spending in the United States only went up 1.3%. Lowest in history! Hello? Hello? Lowest ever. Oh, lowest ever in a three-year period, anyway. And... it's remarkable. How many stories covered this? 23. How many covered the Obamacare website problems? 224, according to the Center for American Progress. Good news, Pick on the president? Oh, let's do that. Oh, man. So, death with dignity. Scott Adams coming face to face with us. He sees. He's talking to the politicians. If you have acted or plan to act in a way that keeps doctor-assisted suicide illegal, I see you as an accomplice in torturing my father and perhaps me as well someday. I want you to die a painful death and soon, and I'd be happy to tell you the same thing to your face. This guy is seriously upset, and with good reason. I was with my father when he died. We were very fortunate to have a hospice nurse who got it and who gave him huge amounts of morphine. I still think he was probably in more pain than he needed to be. He had a stroke, and so he couldn't communicate with us. And his last few hours were rather difficult. But she finally gave him a lot of morphine, and I think that helped him on his way out. And mostly she said, Carl, you can leave now if you want. Your sons are all here with you. Your wife is going to be taken care of. Everything's going to be fine. And he just took a breath, and that was it. And so I think that in many hospice, and this was in his own living room, you know, if it was 2 o'clock in the morning or so, this nurse had just spent the whole evening with us. She was an angel. She said what none of us had the courage to say, frankly, or the experience. It was the first time I'd ever been with somebody who was dying of natural causes. He was dying of a disease, but of mesothelioma and bladder cancer. And I think actually ultimately of dehydration, but in any case. Why don't we do this in more than 2 out of the 50 states in the United States? Allow people to make their own decisions about how to end their lives. Regardless of their age, this is not an old person thing. This is very much not an old person thing. I think, frankly, it's because not only are we afraid to have a conversation about suicide, but even more, which we need to have more of so that there are fewer suicides. And in fact, the studies, there's some good recent studies showing that suicide discussion, it used to be thought that if you talked about suicide that among teenagers, that teenage suicide would go up. Because there have been studies that showed patterns where if a young person commits suicide, that others will do you know, the same thing. Imitation, so is, you know, imitating the, that behavior. But when it's discussed, when there's suicide prevention education classes, it actually goes down. Why aren't we doing this? Why don't we teach kids how to change diapers? Why don't we teach them how to balance checkbooks? Why don't we teach them how to maintain good and healthy relationships? Why don't, you know, we just assume parents are going to do all these things. A lot of, you know, especially in the 32 years since Reagan. I mean, you know, more than half of all kids in America come home to an empty home. Latchkey kids. A lot of parents aren't equipped to even teach these things. They're afraid to bring them up. They don't know how to do it. So anyway. Jason in Dumont, New Jersey. You think I don't like Republicans, Jason? Really?
Well, the way you've been talking about Republicans when it comes to the Affordable Health Care Act, it's mm-hmm. almost as if you're vilifying them.
And sure,
you're not
I am.
The only one to blame for it. I'm calling as a moderate, and I can't.
What does moderate mean, Jason? I've never met a moderate. What makes you a moderate?
Well, I have some liberal ideas. I agree with some liberal ideas and some conservative ideas.
Okay. For example.
For example, you know, I am very pro gun. I guess the word would be.
So you think everybody should be able to own a shoulder-fired rocket launcher?
You know, that's where I'm a bit more in the middle of the road. You know, I am all for everybody who is able to, you know, pass the checks and pass tests being able to own a handgun or a hunting rifle, but I don't see the purpose in anything more than that.
Then you agree with me on guns. The weapons of war should not be in the hands of civilians.
Right.
Okay, then... According to the Republican Party, you are not pro-gun, you are anti-gun.
But in general, you know, it seems that, you know...
You said, why am I vilifying Republicans? I mean, you're now, by Republican standards, you are a turncoat. You said you described that as a conservative position. I'm a sports shooter. I'm all in favor of people being able to own sports shooting weapons, hunting weapons, and self-defense weapons. But I don't see where weapons of war fit into that category. I don't see where anybody needs an AR-14.
You know, also, I don't jump at the idea of, you know, forcing people to say under God when saying the Pledge of Allegiance.
Right.
Maybe, you know.
Well, it wasn't even added until 1954 or 56 or something like that as a sop to you know, demagogue Republicans who thought that they would. I mean, it wasn't there for a long, long time. But okay, so
yes,
those are
general.
So it
seems like what you're saying is all Republicans only want an elitist America, and I can't wrap my head around that because even a third grader can realize that would never work.
Okay, well, I've never used those words to the best of my knowledge, but here's a question I would
not
put to
that,
you, Jason.
But
what legislation have Republicans in the last 50 years originated, championed, and passed that helps the average working person? I can give you a long list that help corporations and help billionaires, but that would help the average working American. Can you name one?
You know, I really can't, but I can't believe that all Republicans are evil.
I'm not talking about evil. If you want my characterization of Republicans, it's not good or evil. It's that the Republican Party is the party of the rich, the wealthy, and the corporate, and including the transnational corporate. Not even American corporate. I mean, Nancy Pelosi passed a piece of legislation when she was Speaker of the House that said that no longer could you have a tax break for taking apart an American factory and shipping it over to China. We actually pay companies to do that, you know, with our tax dollars, the tax dollars that you and I pay in. Mitt Romney did it with Sensata, and in fact, during the election. And sent over 100 jobs over to China. And he got a tax break for it. He got money from us to do that. She passed a law saying we're not going to do that anymore. Republicans in the Senate filibustered it. They want transnational corporations to be able. This is why we've lost 50,000 factories, not 50,000 jobs, 50,000 factories just since George Bush became president, the most recent Bush. And we've lost a lot more than that since Reagan. And, you know, trying to reverse that kind of legislation. Republicans that will have nothing to do with it. The Democrats are all for it. I can give you a long list of things that Democrats have done that have helped the average person, from health care reform to the stimulus to Wall Street reform to the ending the Iraq war to drawing down the Afghanistan war to getting bin Laden to saving the auto industry stopping a depression to improve our image abroad. I mean, there's a great list over here. It's a DU, but I think it's going viral over on Facebook. Dramatically cut oil imports. Heavily invested in renewable technology, increased support for veterans, passed credit card reform, improved safety, food safety programs, school nutritions, expanded hate crimes protections, advanced women's rights, got an agreement with Iran on nuclear weapons, got an agreement with Syria on chemical weapons, avoided going to war, cut the deficit. By the way, all of these things opposed by Republicans. Can you please tell me, you say I'm vilifying Republicans. I would love to praise Republicans. The last thing that I can think of that's praiseworthy of the Republicans was, and I mentioned this, last week, was in 1986 when Ronald Reagan put Charles Keating in prison. He went after not all of them. He didn't go after Neil Bush because he was his vice president's son, even though he made a million bucks on the SNL debacle. But, he put, I believe, about 600 of those banksters in prison in 1986. As a consequence, he had deregulated the SNLs in 83, huge mistake, and it let the predators in, and they crashed the system in 86. And so he fully nationalized the SNLs, totally screwed the stockholders. They all ended up owning nothing. The federal government took over all the SNLs, and then over the next 20 years, William Seidman, a good Republican from Grand Rapids, reprivatized them, showed a profit to the government. Reagan did it right. We should have, George W. Bush should have done the same thing in 2008. He didn't. But Reagan did one good thing right. And I'm sure he did other good things right, too. But I can't think of anything that the Republican Party has done in the last 15 or 20 years that's worth praising. If you can give me one, Jason, I'll change my tune.
You make a lot of good points. I guess my last question would be, how can I, someone who works two jobs and go to school, deal with the adequate research?
Well, you shouldn't have to work two jobs and go to school. The Democrats would like you to go to school for free and get enough pay that you can work one job. The Republicans think it's cool you're working two jobs.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Remember during the campaign, George W. Bush had that woman, she had three jobs. He says, isn't that cute? That's the American way. No, it's not. Jason, thanks for the call. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Norma in Montgomery, Alabama. Hey, Norma, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind today?
Good afternoon, Tom. First of all, I picked up your book yesterday. I'm rather amazed at the list of books that you've written in the front. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
But I wanted to let you know that down here, we're still fighting over whether or not we're ever going to get the ACA. We have people demonstrating on the Capitol steps demanding that we expand Medicaid and accept the money and accept the programs. And our governor, who happens to be a dentist, is refusing to let us have it.
What is your governor's name in Alabama?
Robert Bentley.
Forgive my ignorance on that. This just seems to me like the ultimate meme, the ultimate thought virus, the ultimate bumper sticker for this. Have you seen anybody with a billboard or a sticker or a sign holding up that says bring back our tax money from Washington or give us back our tax money from Washington in the form of health care?
You're forgetting this is Montgomery, Alabama.
Yeah, but still, I mean, people in Montgomery, Alabama, this was Ronald Reagan's thing. It's your money. Those tax dollars are your money. The government shouldn't take them. Or if the government does take them, it should be giving them back to you in various forms, in the form of tax credits or whatever. And that's what Obama's trying to do. He's trying to take the federal tax dollars that have been, paid in by all the states and give them back to the people in the states. It's your money. He's trying to give it back to you.
I know. But, we'll take this as an example. We just had an election to replace another person who quit in the middle of their term.
Right.
In my district, we got about a population of 40,000, maybe 20,000 registered voters, and we had a little over 3,700 show up to vote. Does that give you an idea of what is going on here?
Yeah.
Nobody pays any attention. Nobody cares.
Right.
Except meanwhile, you have poor people screaming, where's our health care? But nobody is doing anything about it.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
we have,
you know, we need to educate them, Norma. And I, if there's people out there protesting and holding up signs saying, you know, take the money, instead of take the money, it should be take our money or bring back our money or get our money back from Obama. You know,
well,
I mean, you could even phrase it as an anti-Obama, right? Hey, Governor, did you say Bentley was his name?
Yes.
Yeah. Governor Bentley, get our money back from Obama so we can have health care.
Well, you know, it just it kind of amazes me because, you know, we have one health care company in this state. It has a monopoly.
You mean one health insurance company?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the Big Blue. And when I get my paperwork as a disabled retired person, of course, I'm on Medicare. And I get a bill, I get a piece of paper back saying doctor submitted $138, Medicare approves $83, pays $68, and Big Blue is my copay, should pay 20%, they pay $3.31. I can't make this math work.
Yeah.
You know, what is going on here in this state that this monopoly doesn't even pay my doctor?
It's amazing. Yeah. You've got, I don't, not knowing Alabama, I don't know the answer to that, Norma, but I do know that it's screwed up. And hopefully what's going to happen is as the states that take the Medicare money and have exchanges that work, as we go into the 2014 election, this is going to swing from being a debatable issue to an undebatable issue. Norma, thank you for the call. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. Andrea in Palm Springs, California. Hey, Andrea, you wanted to talk about the death of dignity laws?
Yes. Hello. I admire you so much for what you're doing. And let me preface my comment by saying that I have been a caregiver in my life for over 2 decades, and my husband died in 1996 of Parkinson's, and within 10 years, virtually everyone else in my family had died of one disease or another. And
oh my.
Although there may not be a good death, I've seen some pretty horrible deaths.
Mm.
And you know, been in the trenches, and so I want to speak to the death with dignity issue. And one of the arguments put forth against these laws is that there will be a finagling or an acceleration of death on behalf of organ donation. And I have never been in a situation involving organ donation on one side or the other, so I don't have a dog in the fight in terms of that issue.
It's a straw man, Andrea.
But I really do feel we can sell our plasma, our blood, our hair, our sperm, our eggs. I feel it's immoral that a person can't own their organs to sign a contract in any way to say upon their death their heirs will receive so much for their donatable organs, for instance. Everyone else in the process of organ donation makes money.
Here's the problem is all the things that you can sell are things that you can sell and still stay alive. If you're talking about selling livers, you can't stay alive after you've done that. And, you could sell one kidney, I suppose, and stay alive. But it puts you in a situation where you're much more vulnerable to death. So, but I can tell you that the experience of the state of Washington and the experience of the state of Oregon, this has been going on for 4 or 5 years now, has been that, the death with dignity laws are used rarely. It's just a few hundred a year, the times that people actually use these. More than half the time, people get the prescription and end up dying of natural causes, and that there is absolutely no correlation between getting that prescription, having that bottle on the table next to the bed, and organ donation. There's none. So you can put your mind to rest on that.
I feel that even as a separate issue, it would eliminate the black market, because in fact your network, I see you on Free Speech, has a whole program on the black market for organs, and that if people were, you know, the,
well, that's usually, that's mostly an overseas
body,
market,
even for bone tissue, and you know what they use in dental work and things is like $200,000, and there's so many people, if they knew they could will all of their usable body parts upon their death just for the benefit of their heirs, that would upend it. It's like the whole illegal drug trade.
Yeah.
If it were regulated and taxed.
You raise an interesting question, and I'm not. You raise a really interesting question. It's a complex question. It would be a good one to bring up with an ethicist. Andrea, thank you very much for the call. Lawrence in New York City. Hey, Lawrence.
Hi, Tom. I have a friend who had cancer, and they couldn't access legal marijuana, and that's to a patient's rights, the right to, you know.
You still there, Lawrence? Lawrence, it sounds like we've lost you. I'm sorry, I can't hear you any longer. Sherry in Portland, St. Lucie, Florida. Hey, Sherry, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm well. What's on your mind?
I watch you up, and I'm sorry to hear about your father, and I think hospice is a wonderful place to be with him.
Mm-hmm.
When it happens, that's a wonderful place.
Yeah, it was hospice at home, actually.
I watched the documentary, my husband and I, last year on Dignity with Death, and frankly, I found it disgusting. The woman in Oregon who did it, who's piloting this, can you hear me?
I can, yes.
Okay. She let her family down a road that was awful. She didn't take the pill. She was supposed to take it when she was ready to go. She took herself in the hospital, kept lingering it. After her death, she stood there with her a woman who actually felt so guilty, didn't even want to be there. I mean, to get somebody to stand at her bedside and hold her hand when she died.
Mm.
My husband and I were appalled what she did to her children. On the other hand, in Oregon, after that was passed, there was a man who had cancer who was in his 50s. And he got sent home one of those letters. And he was crying because they didn't want to give him the medical help he deserved to even try.
Yeah.
So I see an evil side of this, too. As long as the states cannot dictate, and they did do that in Oregon to that man. If you watch that documentary, and the woman was appalling what she did to her children.
Yeah, I can't speak to a documentary I haven't seen, Sherry, but I was on the air in Oregon. I did a local program there for 4 years on KPOJ, and during that debate and after, and I interviewed a lot of people from Washington State who had relatives go through this, or who themselves were dying, or you know, near death, and had these prescriptions. And it's a whole lot better than the only option you've got is to get somebody to bring you a gun, isn't it?
Well, how about the morphine your father used?
Well, that's,
I can see where they can get out of control and do pick and choose.
I think, you know, I think that if that hospice nurse gave my father an overdose of morphine that killed him, she could be prosecuted. And I personally don't think she did. I think he was dying. I mean, he was at the point where he was doing the death rattle thing, you know, and she just helped him go out gently. But he should have really gone a day before that. He was in a lot of pain that last day. Mesothelioma is an excruciatingly painful disease. And I don't know. I can't speak to the documentary, Sherry. It just seems that people should be able to have some say in their own death. Thank you very much for the call. I'll have to look for that documentary. We'll be back. We're going to be talking with Baruch Higginbaum about the British Crossrail. It should be interesting.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartmann.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartmann.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And Baruch Feigenbaum. Am I saying that right, sir?
That's pretty good, Tom. Baruch Feigenbaum, but that's very
Feigenbaum. Fun. Okay. I keep wanting to say Baruch Atad, don't I? Anyway. Feigenbaum, a transportation policy analyst with the Reason Foundation, Reason.org, of course, one of the Koch brother funded by and large organizations, if I have that correct.
Some funding.
Yeah.
A lot of resources.
Yeah. But by and large, a libertarian organization, shall we say.
Yeah.
Great Britain right now is doing this British Crossrail thing, and a fascinating piece on it in today's Financial Times, in fact, and some of the you know, this, they're turning it into a work of art and architecture and everything else, but they're also, you know, doing this radical improvement in transportation. A Japanese company, correct me if I'm wrong, has offered to build a maglev train from Washington, D.C. to Baltimore, which could pull away a lot of business, or some business anyway, from Amtrak, which would not be a good thing for Amtrak. But on the other hand, America would have a flavor, a taste of what the rest of the world has in terms of high-speed rail. The Chinese have built the equivalent of Chicago to New York, 300-mile-an-hour train. They did that in less than 5 years. That was completed about 2.5 years ago. Why is it that the rest of the world is, you know, I've been on the high-speed trains in France and Germany. Why is it that the rest of the world has high-speed transportation, most of it publicly funded, but libertarians and conservatives like yourself are opposed to that unless somebody can make a buck off it? What's wrong with the public infrastructure? And doesn't public infrastructure like this actually encourage business? I mean, you know, look at the Northeast Corridor. That's where the business used to be. Still is.
Well, thanks, Tom. Those are actually a lot of good questions. Let me first thank you for having me on and try to take a stab at those.
Sure.
So, first of all, in terms of the Northeast Corridor, we are actually supportive of looking at high-speed rail. We think that's the one place between Washington and Boston where high-speed rail in the U.S. actually makes sense. And I think it would have been a lot more logical if President Obama had started with that corridor.
Well, he did. You know, he tried to fund that early on. That was part of the original stimulus bill. The Republicans stripped it out.
Well, we were looking at it was one of a number of projects. And I think what they were looking at specifically was funding that project first instead of giving grants to a various number of states. But regardless, I do think that's a good project to look at. And I do think maglev is a potential technology to look at, too, as well. Obviously,
works well in Japan.
Number of politicians on the board, both Democrats and Republicans, looking at that. And so what our position is that these high-speed rail and maglev proposals are extremely expensive. And we do think they should be funded by the private sector, at least in part, or through public-private partnerships.
Why?
Well, you have other methods of travel on those corridors, such as rail, such as cars, such as bus. Inner-city megabus now is a real burgeoning industry that are basically funded without taxpayer funding. And we think if those modes...
Oh, wait a minute. That's not true. Every single one of those methods that you just described is going over public rights of way. They are all funded by with taxpayer funding.
Right. They're funded by taxpayer funding, but it's a user-pay, user-benefit system. So the folks who are using the corridor, so example, if you're driving an I-95 and you're a motorist using that corridor, you're paying gas taxes in order for the upkeep of that road.
Right.
If you're a passenger and you're flying on the plane, you pay a passenger charges to make sure it's kept up. And we think that's a great method. We really like user pay, user benefit, but we don't think that that would necessarily be successful for rail. And that's our
Why?
Issue, is that there would be major subsidies.
Why not?
Well, when we take a look at these projects, especially in other countries, and obviously Europe, you mentioned France and Germany have some systems, as well as Japan. Those countries are a little different than the U.S. They have extremely high densities. They also have strong historic urban cores, and you do see that somewhat in the Northeast, especially with New York and Boston, that make these lines a lot more realistic because of the population density. And so in other places across the U.S., we've been sort of skeptical that those densities weren't there. But we do think in the Northeast they might be, which is one reason why we would support it.
Well, and in the rest of the United States, I mean, we have air travel, I mean, and which is going through public airwaves, and we pay our taxes. I mean, obviously airlines pay landing fees to help support the cost of the airports, but the FAA itself and all that stuff, that's paid out of the general fund. So, you know, we're supporting transportation. What do you, are you suggesting that just putting Amtrak out of business? I mean, because that would be the effect of Amtrak is making money on the Northeast Corridor, and they're using that to subsidize, you know, the Crescent down to Louisiana. They're using that to subsidize the, I forget what it's called, the train that goes all the way out to Los Angeles. Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, we are saying that we think the idea of privatizing the Northeast Corridor, the Amtrak routes, is something to look at. And we do understand that they use some of that money to subsidize other routes. But with the option of automobiles, intercity bus, and train, we're just not convinced that Amtrak is needed on some of these corridors, especially the long-distance ones where they lose a lot of money.
Why not have a national infrastructure? I mean, a national transportation infrastructure. Have you ever been in Europe, used the high-speed rail?
Yes.
Okay, so then you know that, I mean, you can go from Paris to Frankfurt on the LTE, and you'll go, you know, 100, in addition to going 150, 200 miles an hour, you'll go 100 miles and not see a big town. I mean, there's a lot of rural area there. It's not high density population, but there's lots and lots of farmland in France and Germany, for that matter. I don't see the population density issues as being hugely different than much of the United States. You know, arguably the Rocky Mountain states or something, but and what you see is that where there is that good high quality public transportation, A, it gets used and gets used very heavily, but B, it provides a seedbed for business. And I would think, you know, being a you know, pro business guys, you would think that having the public, you know, I just don't get why not have public services provide that soil in which government can root itself. Why does everybody have to make a buck off everything? Why can't we just have the commons that provides the basis for people to make a buck?
Well, I guess in some ways it comes down to philosophy. We tend to think that the free market approach, where you, I guess by necessity, have someone making a dollar.
But there's no such thing as a free market.
Well, we tend to believe that it's the best option out there, although obviously there are barriers to it. But I would ask, we are not opposed to public-private partnerships where you have the private sector bringing some of their best resources to the table and the public.
I'm talking about entirely public sector. Why not have a nationally run rail system? It's working fine in Japan. It's working fine in Korea.
We would point out that the U.S. is different than some of these other countries in terms of the structure, in terms of automobile ownership. The system in Japan was built before automobile ownership was very popular in that country.
So was ours.
Well,
ours was built in the 1860s.
But our system was, of course, not at that standard that theirs was. And ours was a system that now is mainly used for freight, not used for passengers.
But only because, by and large, it's been privatized. I mean, you know, one of the big problems Amtrak has is that they have to rent private rails.
Well, one of the reasons it was privatized was because the freight railroads in the 1960s were going out of business. And so one of the things that the U.S. government did was they decided to take on the burden of the passenger rail service, because unlike some of the other countries, passenger rail service in the U.S., at least since the mid-20th century, was never profitable. And they were worried that these freight rail lines were going to go out of business. So that's not necessarily the case in Europe and some other places.
Okay. But we're going to have to to wrap it at that. But thank you for dropping by.
Well, I appreciate it.
Interesting conversation.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And you can read Baruch's writing over at reason.org. Thank you so much, Baruch Feigenbaum. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Cliff in Canyon Country, California. Hey, Cliff, what's on your mind? Thanks for watching Free Speech.
Oh, I love it. Hi, Tom. I tuned in a little late today to your TV program, but you were talking about a list of some pro-Obama programs.
A lot of them had nothing to do with Obama. Well, this guy called in and he said, how come you hate Republicans? And I said, I don't hate Republicans. I just don't think that they've done a single thing for the working people in this country, just only for corporations and rich people. And, you know, here's a list of things that have been passed by Democrats that have helped working people in America. Can you give me even one thing that the Republicans have passed in the last 15 to 20 years? And he was unable to do so. Can you do so?
Oh, no, I agree with you. I didn't catch that part.
So
no,
it's not that I hate Republicans. It's just, you know, I think that we need to acknowledge the reality that Republicans pass legislation that cuts regulations and thus makes business more profitable at the expense of consumers, and that cuts taxes on particularly millionaires and billionaires. Maybe, you know, they'll throw a few bones to the average working person, but, you know, like the big Bush tax cut, the average working person made, what, $200 a year, I think, something like that. Whereas, you know, the Wall Street billionaires were making hundreds of millions of dollars in tax cuts. And they cut corporate taxes like crazy. But they will not do things that, for example, bring our jobs back home. Nancy Pelosi, you know, got this bill out of Congress that would have stopped giving tax breaks to Mitt Romney's Bain Financial for taking Sensata apart brick by brick and shipping it over to China. Actually passed it out of the House of Representatives, went to the Senate, the Republicans filibustered it.
Well, especially these last 5 years of Republicans.
That's what I'm talking about.
You know, that the caucus room, the caucus room restaurant.
Conspiracy, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
well,
so what's your disagreement with me?
Well, just a couple of the ones you listed, improving our image abroad and cutting oil imports and support for veterans and food safety programs. I mean, there's two sides to every story, though, because you say, you know, it's improved our image abroad, but I think his expansion of the drone program killing civilians is hurting that image.
I agree. But I think that's a hell of a lot better than, you know, declaring any more wars on any, you know, if you had President McCain, we would right now be in a war with Syria and almost certainly a war with Iran. And instead, Obama's gotten us out of Iraq.
You always lower the bar by comparing him to Romney or McCain. I agree.
But you know, who else is there to compare him to? Those are the people he was running against.
I know. We're much better off with Obama than either of those Republicans. I agree 100%.
Yeah.
But I still think that you cut President Obama too much slack on certain things. Like when you say cutting oil imports, but that's expanding fracking in this country. He still has an all-of-the-above energy policy, which includes nuclear energy.
I don't disagree broadly, but we have largely cut oil imports because he has increased gasoline standards on cars.
That's also true. Like I said, there's two parts to all these stories. Yeah. How about the veterans? Remember that buckling floor with all those veterans files, you know?
Oh, I know. It's a terrible mess. George Bush got us into two wars without even thinking about what he was going to do about the veterans. Didn't put a penny of funding into that. Bernie Sanders is now chairman of the Veterans Committee. He's trying to get cash for it. But the Republicans are saying, no, we can't afford it. We got to cut spending, even for veterans. So, Cliff, you know, take it up with the Republican senator. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. We'll be right back. Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. And Wayne in Chicago. Hey, Wayne, what's on your mind?
Okay. All right, Tom, let me cut this speakerphone down.
Sure.
Yes. The guest that you just had, the libertarian, the name of the website should be absolutelyno reason.org.
Let's not pick on a guy who's not here, okay? Come on, Wayne.
You said a guy's not here to defend himself.
Yeah, yeah. So.
Okay, well, whatever. But anyway,
But I am starting to identify these guys that are funded by the Koch brothers as being funded by the Koch brothers. I think they've gotten a free ride long enough.
One of his reasons for privatizing a national system like you were suggesting is population density. Well, we don't have enough people, so we need to privatize it. I mean, it's complete. All of the theories that I hear from these guys are mostly complete nonsense. But anyway, what I called to talk about was the healthcare thing that you were talking about when you first started.
Death with dignity?
Death with dignity.
That Scott Adams' dad should have been allowed to go quietly and peacefully and gently rather than suffer.
This is the deal. Our healthcare system in the United States is wicked because what they want to do is keep people alive as long as they can. Like if a person has cancer, they want to keep people alive as long as they can to make money off of them.
Yeah.
Now, the doctors who know how to cure certain types of cancer, what they do is they go to those doctors and tell those doctors, you're going to stop doing what you're doing or else we're going to take your medical license. If you still don't stop doing what you're doing, we're going to lock you up. Tom, there are people locked up in prison right now because they know how to cure cancer, and the judge sent them to jail right here in the United States right now.
Yeah, I've heard that, Wayne, and I've read some studies that seem to back that up. The cancer cures. I mean, on the other hand, you've got a lot of people who are out there putting out, and I'm super familiar with this because Louise and I both just went through this. This whole thing with having cancer and getting on the other side of it and now being cancer free. And as far as we know, there's an enormous number of alternatives out there. But I think that the larger issue is that somewhere between a quarter and a half of all Medicare spending is spent in the last couple months of life. I don't have the statistic right in front of me, but it's mind boggling that, you know, when somebody is given 6 months or thereabouts to live, I don't want to make this into policy, but did you see, Wayne, have you caught, it was last week, it was one of the most read articles in the New York Times, and then about 6 months ago, there was another version of it. It was an excerpt from a book about the same title, which was basically called How Doctors Die. Did you see that?
No, I didn't. I'm getting ready to write it down, though.
Yeah. Check that out. Go to the New York Times website and just type in How Doctors Die. And it's an article about how doctors die differently than the rest of us. Doctors choose, when they know that they're going to die, they choose to stop the treatment. And other than what might keep them from, you know, having a stroke or a heart attack or something, let's say if they've got cancer, and just die, you know, quietly surrounded by family and friends. No heroic efforts. You know, don't hit me with the paddles. Don't stick the tubes down my throat. Don't give me feeding tubes. Just, you know, let me go. Most doctors die quietly at home, whereas most people are getting all this heroic end-of-life stuff that's incredibly expensive and therefore incredibly profitable for our for-profit healthcare system. And ultimately, people die anyway, and in many cases, they die a much more painful death than they would have died if they had died the way the doctors do, because their life has been extended out in ways that, A, have no quality, and B, by, you know, pushing it to that last ragged little bit, that last ragged little bit can be damn painful stuff. And it's just fascinating to see and to read and hear about, learn about, get a sense of how differently in America, physicians who routinely deal with death choose themselves to die, how they choose to die, which is basically to just kind of go with it, go naturally, and not to do heroic, and not to do the third round of chemo, and not, you know, all that kind of thing, knowing that it's a whole thing. So I think that you wanted to make a point, Wayne?
Yeah. Now, my father used to get Penthouse, Playboy, and Penthouse magazine, but I'm specifically talking about Penthouse now with Bob Guccione.
Mm-hmm.
This is way back in the day. I got to look it up. Maybe it's on the internet. Bob Guccione's wife had cancer from head to toe.
Mm.
And the doctors gave her 6 weeks, I forgot, 6 months, whatever. And she went to a doctor, alternative medicine doctor.
Right.
He had a concoction hooked up, whereas a part of his concoction was a component of jet fuel, Tom.
Hmm.
He gave her that concoction, cured her cancer from head to toe. The government threatened to lock him up forever and throw away the key.
Wow. I can't speak to that story, Wayne, because I don't know about it. But I do know that, you know, sometimes people come back. Sometimes people come back with even things that are supposedly placebos, like homeopathy. But those, rather than having a discussion about whether or not there are alternatives to conventional medicine, because I agree with you, there are alternatives and we should explore them. There does come a point in most people's lives, and I think there will come a point in all of our lives, in your life and my life, Wayne, you know, and hopefully, right, it's going to be a long, long time from now, where we're going to have to say, okay, it's time to check out. And wouldn't it be nice to be able to do it surrounded by family and friends gently and pleasantly? And that's what I'm talking about, the whole death with dignity thing. Wayne, thanks a lot for the call. So you always give me something to think about. I appreciate it. Thank you. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So how would you want to go when your time comes? Exposing the con in conservative. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Kathy in Valparaiso, Indiana. Am I saying that right, Kathy?
Yes, you are.
Well, welcome
to the program. How are you doing today, Mr. Hartman?
I am well. I hope you are, too.
I'm hanging in there. I have to, first of all, offer my condolences about Higgins.
Thank you.
And as an animal lover and had cats all my life, I find it strange that Higgins stuck around you and your wife, because as I said, I've raised animals all my life. Usually cats will go and hide when they want to die. They want to be alone.
Yeah, well, that last day he kept doing that. He kept going up to the bridge, to the top of the boat, and finding a place to hide. And so Louise brought him down and put him in the bed between us, in a little cat bed between us, and put a little diaper on him because he was incontinent. And I think he felt like, and then, you know, we just curled around him, and I think he felt hidden then. And he also... That last day, actually the last two or three days, Louise had been giving him, I forget the name of the drug, a little bit of Valium and a little bit of Tramadol, you know, which is a painkiller. And so this was the dose prescribed by the veterinarian to just, you know, make sure that there's no pain and that he's not in anxiety. And so he seemed to be okay. He just finally, you know, once we turned the lights off, he closed his eyes and that was it. He went. So, anyway, back to you, Kathy. Kathy, you got to listen to your phone, not the radio. Hello? Kathy's listening to the radio. Kathy, I'm going to put you on hold for a minute, and we'll come back to your call. You've got to listen to the phone, though, because there's a delay on the radio and on TV. Paul in Lucerne, California. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, Tom. We're talking about death with dignity. Well, that's just a casualty of when the country, someone decided for the country that they're going to replace integrity with greed. That greed was going to be our national motto instead of integrity.
Right. Well, I think that happened in the 80s. I mean, that was, you know, Reagan, the whole Reagan Revolution, that was the essence of it.
In the 70s, though, when they started letting you make money on health care, that was like a giant mistake. You can never let people make money on health care.
Yeah.
Because greed becomes the factor instead of caring.
Yeah, and that moved state by state. Because I remember back in the 70s, I was doing business in Michigan, and Blue Cross Blue Shield in Michigan was a not-for-profit corporation. It may still be in that state. I don't know. It varies from state to state. But
yeah,
in any case.
They seemed to, when they replaced, you know, integrity with greed, the key TV Christians seem to step in there and give them.
But you would think that, you know, I can understand the hospitals wanting to make money off dying people. But you would think that the health insurance industry would be in favor of death with dignity laws so that they don't have to pay as much out to the hospitals for that. I mean, those last couple of weeks of life can be the most expensive of a person's entire life, and much of it is unnecessary. And in fact, much of it is unnecessarily intrusive and painful and difficult. And that I don't get. Paul, thanks for the call. Good point. Kathy, want to try it again?
Hi. I'm sorry about that, but I had my TV on mute. I don't know what happened.
Uh-huh.
But the original reason I called you is because of what you were saying about politics. And I've been wanting to tell you or remind you, if you've ever seen the 1998 movie Bullworth, with
yes.
Warren Beatty and Halle Berry.
I did see
Doesn't
it.
That seem like what's going on now? Or what's been going on?
Yeah.
It's scary how close that came to what's going on in the world now.
I'd have to go back and watch the movie again. The main storyline that I remember was that he was sick and tired of having to raise money, and that he decided that he was going to go out and tell the people how corrupt the political system was, and ultimately it took him up and then took him down.
Right, because he originally, in the beginning of the movie, he wanted to commit suicide. He was getting a life insurance policy.
That's right, and a young woman turned him around or something. His
Halle
girlfriend,
Berry, yeah.
Yeah, Halle Berry.
Yeah, he was sleep deprived. Yeah, he was sleep deprived, and he went off the deep end and went partying with everybody, and then he told the truth.
Yeah.
He went into the black churches. He went out on the street and he told the truth. Well, it ended up the insurance agent was the one that killed him in the end. But the other movie is pertaining to what you're talking about, dignity with dying.
Yeah.
I don't know how, you're just a few years older than me, but Soylent Green.
Soylent Green. I never saw the movie, but I read the book back in the day.
Where people were a certain age, you had diabetes, whatever, then they would put you to death.
Right.
But what society didn't realize was they were making crackers, which fed humanity out of the dead people.
That's right.
What has happened is, because I firmly believe, like you do, that we have the right to pick when we should die. I'm a pain patient that can't take pain medicine. Let me tell you, I'm the first one to tell you. I was ready to call Dr. Kevorkian when he was alive.
Yeah.
But anyway, I think this is what, with anything that starts out good, whether it was the internet or anything else, it will be twisted, it will be turned around, and I think that's what people are afraid of.
I understand that, but we've had a laboratory now for at least 6 years in Washington State and Oregon, and the one protection of requiring two independent physicians to sign off on that medication before you can get a prescription for it, combined with the fact that pretty much everybody can figure out how to kill themselves, you know, even without that, if they're really intent on suicide. People do it all the time. I think there's enough protection built into it that the Washington State model is a good model. But I do get your point. Kathy, thanks for the call. Thanks for hanging on. Vi in Ripon, California, or Ripon?
Ripon.
Ripon. Hey, what's up?
Well, I would just, I'm a Democrat, and I would like to commend that mediocre Republican that spoke to you on the air. That took a tremendous amount of courage.
Sure.
And he was really trying to work through some hard issues and was standing up for what he believed. And that's neat. And I think there are a lot of everyday Republicans out there that agree with him.
Except I wasn't sure what he agreed with. I mean, he was in favor of...
He agreed with you on the gun situation, and he didn't get a chance to say a whole lot. But to me, he sounded like, you know, a mind that was working. He wasn't being led by the nose. And as far, and you did not stay 15 or 20 years to go back to see if a Republican had ever done anything for the common man. You said 50.
Well, either one.
And I was just wondering if you were including Dwight D. Eisenhower.
I think Dwight Eisenhower was the last Republican who actually bragged about, and this was, you know, in the in his reelection campaign in 1956, in his reelection campaign, he bragged about expanding Social Security. He bragged about expanding unemployment benefits and lengthening them, and he bragged about increasing union membership. And I, you know, the next president after him was Richard Nixon, and who never talked about that stuff. And Richard Nixon gets credit for the EPA, but Nixon tried to veto it once. I mean, that was shoved down his throat by Democrats. And I just don't think there's been a decent Republican since Eisenhower. And if you're old enough to remember, if you look up in the history books, nobody knew if Eisenhower was going to run as a Democrat or a Republican until 1951. You know, when he came back from the war, everybody wanted him to run in 1950. The election was in 52. But in 1950, there were huge draft Eisenhower movements in both parties. And he did not come out and say which party he was going to run on until 1951. And he decided that he would run as a Republican. And I think that part of that was that, you know, people had had Democrats as presidents for so long that they were really ready to try out a Republican. And so he just made a choice that was the appropriate choice. But I think Dwight Eisenhower was the last president that we've had who really was transpartisan.
Yes. If I may make a point, I know you're tremendously knowledgeable, and I enjoy that you share that with us. But my point being that there has not been an honest or good Democrat a Democrat president from that era onward. I mean, you're talking about, we know what Reagan did, but what about Clinton and his NAFTA? And now we've got Obama with TPP trying to slip that in. And
I don't think he's going to be able to do it.
If NAFTA was disastrous for this country, TPP is going to just destroy it.
Yeah, but I don't think that you can take a single, and I agree with you. And that said, it's the Democrats who are in favor of marriage equality. It's the Democrats who are in favor of the Dream Act, bringing in, you know, a comprehensive immigration reform for that matter. It's the Democrats who are in favor of raising the minimum wage. It's the Democrats who are in favor of extending unemployment benefits while the Republicans want to shorten them. It's the Democrats who are in favor of strengthening Social Security and Medicare while the Republicans want to privatize them. I think that there are very significant differences between the parties. And, you know, one issue, that or drones, I don't think we should allow to define.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I don't think we should allow it to define an entire presidency any more than the Vietnam War should define Johnson's presidency, although tragically it did. Bye. Thank you for the call. Welcome back. Bill in Mount Ida, Arkansas. Hey, Bill, what's on your mind? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
I just wanted to talk about the right to die thing.
Mm-hmm.
My mom had stomach cancer. Mm. It started as stomach cancer. She had like three operations over about 10 years. And I think it started with a misdiagnosis. It just wasn't diagnosed to start with.
Mm.
But most of the medical system these days is dealing with symptoms and not causes.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't want to die. She was convinced that the medical system could. They were having the fight over stem cell research back then, right? They actually had the technology to manufacture a new stomach for her, but they were just fighting over.
Well, they still don't have that technology, Bill. I mean, they're.
Well, they're doing all kinds of stuff with.
They're moving in that direction.
And other things, it's coming on.
I don't disagree, but what's your point about death with dignity?
Anyway, allopathic medicine, the way it is now, treats symptoms and diseases.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't support or create health and wellness. You know,
right. By and large, and the one area where it does support health and wellness, and that would be good pain care. We're seeing, tragically because of drug abuse, But we're seeing it getting harder and harder and harder for physicians to even prescribe drugs. I know, you know, when I had this frozen shoulder, I was in excruciating pain there for about 5-6 weeks. I mean, just incredible pain. And when I went through it on my right shoulder 4 years ago, my doctor gave me oxycodone, and it knocked the pain out, and I was able to function, and my head was clear because, you know, if you're really in pain and you take, I mean, it was only low dose, it was 5 milligram, but if you take narcotics when you're actually in pain, it doesn't make you goofy. But this time around, this doctor was like, I can't do that, you know, that's too strong. You're going to have to, you know, take a little bit of codeine and some Aleve or something. And it just, like, you know, I went through four weeks of really serious hellish pain that was unnecessary because the doctors are scared to prescribe actual drugs that work. I mean, I find it so bizarre.
Yeah. And there's a lot of doctors like that, and there's a lot of doctors who still hand pills out like candy.
Well, that's the problem. The problem is the drug abuse industry and the drug abusers on the one hand, but you don't solve that problem by taking people who are legitimately in pain. I mean, my blood pressure was spiking. That should have been a clue. You know, it's like, you know, when your blood pressure is 190 over 165 and you say, I'm in pain, there should, you know, somebody should say, oh, maybe there's a relationship between the two, right? But still, it was like, you know, gee, I can't give you anything stronger than that, you know, because I'll be inspected. I'll have, you know, they're going to come look at my license. And I'm like, whoa, really? And I didn't want to go. You can go shopping around for pain doctors, I suppose. But, you know, at that point, then you're getting into the quack system, you know. And why do that? So I think that we need to be paying attention to our system better. Bill, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be back with Victoria Jones with all the news of the day from the Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Minutes before the hour, welcome back. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. Tom Hartman here with you, and Victoria Jones on the line with us, brought to you by the Talk Radio, with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Hi, Victoria.
Hi, Tom.
So, what's up?
Well, it was announced today that there will be a Geneva II, in other words, a second Geneva Peace Conference on Syria. And supposedly on January the 22nd, and as it is only November the 25th, I would say, despite that announcement, that there's a big if in there.
Mm-hmm.
Secretary of State John Kerry saying that the peace talks are the best opportunity to form a transitional government. We are well aware that the obstacles on the road to a political solution are many, and we will enter the Geneva Conference on Syria with our eyes wide open. Spokesman for the Supreme Military Council of the Free Syrian Army told the BBC that the international community hadn't as yet created the right atmosphere for the Geneva talks to go ahead. And the government has said it will, in principle, attend the conference. So even though the announcement has been made, they're making it sound like it's going to happen.
Can you translate that into English for me? What does this mean? Does this mean that what is it that we're struggling with? Is it the fact that Assad is still in power, or is it that our experience in some other countries like Libya, for example, has been that overthrowing the tyrant isn't necessarily the very best thing, and maybe we should keep? I mean, is there a debate inside the State Department or the executive branch about what should be done, or the military for that matter?
No. I mean, the White House wants him out. There's no question that the White House wants them out. The difficulty is getting the two sides to the table.
Which two sides?
The Syrian government and whichever opposition is going to show up. They can't stand each other, and the government calls the armed opposition terrorists.
I see.
The armed opposition, and who are they? There's about 200 different factions. The armed opposition... and we're not including the Al-Qaeda-linked jihadis who are frankly in control. I'm not even including them,
right.
So-called moderates, who are not very moderate. They claim that they would like to see Assad out before they even sit down. So even assuming they're willing to sit down with him, it's tricky. Then you've got the whole question of, is Iran going to be allowed in the room?
Right.
Because many people say that they should be allowed in the room. And then you've got the question that I asked Jay Carney a couple of weeks ago, which nobody ever asked before, which is that, well, considering that the Islamist-linked opposition is making the biggest gains and is now in control of most of the opposition, shouldn't they be at the table?
And that's almost entirely Sunni. So should the Saudis be at the table? Because they're the puppet masters, by and large, of the Sunni opposition in that part of the world, are they not?
And that's being asked. That is being asked.
Very interesting. Okay.
Yeah, and get the Saudis and the Iranians in the same room. That could be combustible.
It could be. That's a moderate word for it, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so what else is up?
The White House has invited physicians to the White House tomorrow, not to tender kindly and lovingly to the President's Health Care Act, but to discuss insurance exchange plans that kick in next year. They've been asked to focus on the January transition to marketplace coverage and how we can work in partnership to ensure continuity and a smooth transition period. They are also saying, the White House is saying, that they are on track with the website to be ready on November the 30th, and that they believe that it will function at 50,000 people, and that if it isn't functioning at 50,000 people, they've got a sort of queuing system, a line system that you can get into now.
Is there any more word on these denial of service attack tools that are proliferating on right-wing websites where people can put them on their computer?
It's not. I mean, it's really interesting. There's really no discussion.
Has anybody asked a question about that at the White House? Has Jay Carney been given an opportunity to respond to that?
No.
That would be an interesting question to ask.
Yes. I'd like to see more information about this.
Yeah. Okay. So what else is happening?
Harry Reid, who last week, the Senate Majority Leader, last week said that he outlined elements of a new sanctions package that he would support taking up after the Thanksgiving recess on Iran. And he was pretty definite about that. Well, today on NPR, he said we'll take a look at this to see if we need stronger sanctions and see if they'll do what they're supposed to do, and said that the various committees will study it and hold hearings if necessary. And if we need more work on this, if we need to do stronger sanctions, I'm sure we will do that. So he's moved his position on sanctions in the light, I think, he's saying he hasn't, but clearly with his language he has, in light of the deal that was struck over the weekend by the six world powers and Iran, the interim six-month deal.
He's moved his position closer to let's work a deal?
Closer to the White House.
Yeah.
And it looks less likely now that I think that the Senate will take up sanctions immediately, and maybe more likely that they will give the White House and the other five world powers the 6 months to negotiate a deal.
I think that's a good thing.
A lot of pressure from Republicans and Democrats and the House not to do that.
Right. I think it's a good thing, though, if it works out that way. And,
it's going to be interesting.
Yeah. Any fallout from the nuclear option here, and when's the president going to propose resubmit his slate for the D.C. Circuit?
They're strategizing about that. They've already got one through. They've got the other two to get through. I think they will come through over the next couple of months. They're strategizing about how to get everybody else through. There are a lot of people to be got through. They've got to work out how to do this. There are an awful lot of ways that Republicans and Mitch McConnell, the minority leader, knows all of them. They can still slow things down to a crawl.
Right, which is why they need to get started right away.
Right, and I think they plan to do that. But there's a lot of people to be put in place.
Amazing. 5 years worth of, basically. I mean, the Republicans have been blocking this stuff. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by GhostsForTheOldGoat.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for being with us today. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And John Rodwin Jr. is on the line with us, a humanist author. Latest book, Holidays and Other Disasters, humanistpress.com, the website. John, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Rodwan, R-O-D-W-A-N, right?
Yes.
Okay. Evacuation day today. This is not a holiday brought to you by Ex-Lax.
Well, it's really not a holiday anyone knows about anymore.
So tell us about it.
Well, at the end of the Revolutionary War, when the British finally left New York City, sort of the last place they had been, people celebrated, and it became a recurring thing. It lasted for over a century. People did this on this date. But it sort of faded away. I have a couple theories as to why that is, but
got largely replaced by Thanksgiving, didn't it?
Essentially replaced by Thanksgiving. I mean, Thanksgiving. Abraham Lincoln set the date that we currently celebrate Thanksgiving during the Civil War. So they were right next to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And since it is sort of about the start of this country, there's the 4th of July, so there are these two other holidays that might seem to have a lot of the things covered. But what interested me about it when I was living in New York at the time was that it's a purely secular holiday. There's no God involved in it. The proclamation Abraham Lincoln signed does refer explicitly to God. That's who we're supposed to be giving thanks to. So I kind of liked the idea of a holiday that was about getting rid of both God and King in a way by setting up a democracy here. So I kind of liked the idea, but I guess the hard one to resurrect.
Yeah. It's the celebration of the departure of the British, basically.
Right.
Evacuating them out of New York, as I recall.
Yes.
Yeah. So... Your book is Holidays and Other Disasters. That's a very provocative title. Why disasters?
Well, to some extent it's tongue in cheek, but on the other hand, it's not because, to go back to Evacuation Day, I mean, holidays do have a connection to some momentous things in history, whether it's the Revolutionary War or the Civil War. But there's also just the association with religion, which can create some uncomfortableness, if not worse, episodes. So that's the idea. Is I'm mainly focusing on the religious elements of the holidays from the perspective of a non-religious person.
Right. So how have religious holidays changed over American history? My understanding is that in early American history, for example, that Christmas pretty much wasn't celebrated at the time of the Revolution. I mean, not in the way that it is now, or do I have that completely wrong?
Well, I think you're right in that different groups, different sects, different versions of Christianity. Some didn't like the idea at all for whatever reason, whether because it wasn't
too much dancing,
too much dancing, or it wasn't sufficiently pure, because as people often point out, Christmas has some sort of pagan roots. I mean, it was a Christian holiday sort of grafted onto a previously existing tradition. So, you know, there were some groups didn't really like that idea.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think at this point it's, you know, been fairly accepted as across denominations, Christian denominations. So.
What holidays have changed the most from the founding of the country to today, or even in the last 100 years? What holidays would we just like no longer recognize?
Well, I suppose Christmas might be one. And this is a sort of internal, not necessarily internal, but humanists disagree about this because lots of people who aren't Christian do like to celebrate the holiday, and other people, of course, want to insist that it, you know, is essentially a religious holiday to celebrate the birth of Jesus Christ. So there's some disagreement there, but the people who aren't religious but do like Christmas often point out, well, now it is essentially a secular holiday because people of all sorts of beliefs celebrate it in ways that have no spiritual component.
Sure.
I'm not sure I believe that, but that certainly wouldn't be recognizable.
Well, what's wrong with somebody who's an atheist or an agnostic saying, hey, you know, let's celebrate Christmas. We can call it Christmas. We don't have to attach any particular religious meaning to it. We can just, you know, hey, it's a holiday. Let's have a party.
Well, I suppose there's nothing wrong with it. In the book, I'm not trying to persuade people to do anything. I'm really just sort of telling some stories.
I think a lot of people have, you know, those anchors, those associations from childhood where even, you know, the tree and the lights and the, you know, or those who grew up Christian. And the same could be true, for other religions and other traditions, you know, the dreidel or the menorah or whatever it may be, that even if they're completely secular, hey, let's just do this because this is something that we remember from our childhood and it makes us feel good.
Well, and plenty of people do that, and
yeah,
that's certainly their right and their choice. I think it's sort of, I guess my inclination is to, you know, sort of do things for reasons that I can explain,
mm-hmm,
and to celebrate something, but to say, well, I'm not really celebrating the thing this day set aside to celebrate,
right,
but I'm just going to have a good time anyway.
But that's almost taking Bill O'Reilly's position, isn't it? I mean, you know, oh, there's a war on Christmas because now they just want to have a party and feel good. And I'm like, well, you know, not everybody thinks, A, Jesus was the guy that, you know, some would have you say, and B, even some who do think he was born in March. And but, you know, so why not just have it be a holiday? I mean, a holiday, not a holy day.
Well, I don't know how you ever solve that one. My position is really, if you want to claim it as a Christian holiday, you're welcome to it. I don't really need it. I can celebrate other things other days.
Yeah, there you go. You mentioned that in 1863, Abraham Lincoln essentially made Thanksgiving into Thanksgiving. I think most people think that Thanksgiving came out of the Pilgrims and has been around forever and was always a primary holiday. And, you know, we started this out by talking about Evacuation Day, that today being Evacuation Day, the evacuation of the British out of New York, and that it eventually was supplanted by Thanksgiving. What's the history of Thanksgiving?
Well, Thanksgiving, there have been Thanksgiving days long before Abraham Lincoln set the date. What he really did was, you know, set it on the date, you know, the Thursday in November that it's celebrated now.
Mm-hmm.
But there had been Thanksgiving days, and they were often on different days of the year in different places, they'd be different days. So really what he was doing was just setting the date for the nationwide celebration. But, yeah, they did exist in various forms.
Yeah. You know, is there an attempt to create holidays among people who are explicitly atheist or, I mean, aside from, you know, like the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster kind of thing, but, I mean, people who are just like, nothing, you know, but here's a holiday. Is there any attempt to create a secular holiday for America?
Oh, yeah, there have been. There's one, I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but it falls, I think, right around Christmas. And the idea is obviously to sort of give people who do want to do all those things you mentioned to celebrate Christmas, but be able to call it something else. So
right,
they come up, they just call it something else.
Right.
That's
Merry Grog Day, you know.
What's that?
Happy Grog Day, you know. you know, a good day to make merry or whatever. Okay, well, very interesting. Thank you for dropping by. And humanist author and humanistpress.com. John Rowden, Jr., the author of the latest book, Holidays and Other Disasters. Thanks for dropping by, sir.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So how do you celebrate holidays? What do they mean? That's an interesting question. Very interesting question. 15 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Margo in Corvallis, Oregon, watching us on Free Speech TV. Hey, Margo, what's up?
Well, this is a follow-up on your discussion of getting atomic particles for transplants and so forth. Here in Oregon, on our driver's license on the back, if you so choose, they put a D, and then it says, upon my death, I want to be an anatomical donor.
Right.
And it's
or
just
an organ donor.
That. Yes, this is an organ. I don't know where else they do it, but they do it in Oregon. And, of course, as you said before, we do have Death with Dignity here, which is, I think, a very good idea. We also have an advanced directive, so I don't know where they have that in other states, but we certainly do, and you can make decisions on do you want them to feed you, do they want to resuscitate you, and
right.
that sort of thing.
Right, right. Although it's interesting, there are still some states that make that very, very difficult. I don't understand the religious impulse to extend life if it means extending suffering. I don't understand that.
Well, neither do I, and that's why, but of course I can't get on the Death with Dignity list yet because I have no terminal illness at the moment.
Sure.
But you can say do not resuscitate on your driver's license if you want to and that sort of thing.
Yeah. And you wonder if somebody does Death with Dignity, they're taking an overdose of a drug, which means that their organs are going to be laced with that drug, too. They may not be appropriate to be an organ donor.
I don't know that.
But that's such a small number of people. I mean, the number of people, in my understanding, the number of people in Oregon and Washington who use Death with Dignity every year is like, you know, 100, 150, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's a very small number. I'm of the impression that there are other states that have this now, but
we looked around this morning getting ready for this show, and as far as we could tell, it was just Oregon and Washington.
All right.
But maybe it's being debated in other states.
Yeah. But that's all I wanted to say, but it is important as far as the anatomical donations that you can put it on your driver's license.
Right. Okay. Thank you, Margo. Thanks for the point. Good to hear from you. Edmund in Hot Springs National Park, watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. Hey, Edmund, what's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. You were talking about Senator Cornyn's tweets regarding Iran.
I didn't bring them up, but I'm glad to talk about them.
Well, my question is, why is that always Israelis' interest is paramount to the interest of the United States? And then my second question is, why is that always disagreeing with Israel, it brands you automatically as anti-Semite?
Good questions. Having spent a fair amount of time in Israel, I can tell you the debates that they have in Israel are active and loud and would not be tolerated in the American media, which I find mystifying. Politicians trying to make Israel an issue. I think some of that, particularly for people like John Cornyn, you know, down in Texas, which does not have a huge Jewish population, it's not about Judaism and Israel. It's about fundamental Christians who believe that if Jews control Israel, that increases the probability that Jesus will return to earth. And that gets very bizarre. Edmund, thank you for the call. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. And Tom in Renton, Washington. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I was inspired by your prologue this morning on death with dignity to make my first ever call.
Well, thank you.
A little background about me. I grew up in a family where both my parents were in the healthcare field. My mom was an RN and my dad was a pharmaceutical salesman. So we frequently talked about these issues around the dinner table. My dad died about 10 years ago from emphysema, which is a especially gruesome death.
Yeah, my dad died from mesothelioma, which is kind of emphysema on steroids. I know what you're talking about.
Exactly. You suffocate.
Yeah, you basically drowned in your own lungs.
He was really sharp right up until the end. In fact, the day he went to the hospital, he had an appointment with an attorney to get his affairs in order, so he would have jumped at the chance. But I wanted to talk about something that's going on here in the state of Washington that is concerning everybody. There's been a series of affiliations between Catholic hospitals and secular hospitals. And most of these secular hospitals are small community-based hospitals where they're kind of the only game in town. Catholic hospitals are governed by what they call ethical and religious directives for Catholic healthcare services. They're called ERDs. And, of course, they affect issues like women's reproductive
Right. They will not perform abortions, for example.
Right. And, for example, my wife had her tubes tied after our last child was born in the hospital. Well, she wouldn't have that option. So
in a Catholic hospital?
In a Catholic hospital.
Would a Catholic hospital perform a vasectomy on a man?
No.
Oh, interesting. Well, at least they're consistent.
They're consistent.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the ACLU was saying that before the end of the year, almost half of the hospital beds in the state of Washington could be affiliated with the Catholic hospitals.
Which means that medical decisions are being made by the Pope, basically.
Yeah, by the ERDs, which is scary. It's caused so much concern that our new governor, Jay Inslee, who was in the House of Representatives and was a very good friend with Al Gore,
right,
has directed the Department of Health to review their certificate of need process for hospitals merging in these acquisitions. Currently, they're taking place in total private, and once they're a fait accompli, they're kind of sprung on the public.
Yeah.
And so if you're in some small rural community, all of a sudden you learn that your rural hospital, which is in dire financial straits because of our current healthcare funding system, has affiliated with a large Catholic institution to stay alive.
Right.
And now your rights are limited.
So and now you can no longer get a vasectomy, among other things. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so
that's...
Dignity, you need to have a prescription for those medications.
Right, but that doesn't require a hospital. You just have to have two doctors sign off on it.
Right, right. But a lot of people are concerned that the number of doctors already are somewhat limited who will do that,
right,
and that this will catch more doctors who are willing to do it.
Do you think that's because a doctor, in order to have admitting privileges or an affiliation with a hospital, must sign some sort of contractual thing that they will behave in a way consistent with the standards of the hospital? And if it's a Catholic hospital, they would therefore not prescribe a drug that would cause a person to die?
Correct. Correct.
Yeah. Well, that's scary.
And now, some people would be able to obtain these medications through the internet or something, but that's problematic because if you die at home under questionable circumstances,
right,
and
they could trigger a homicide investigation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It just blows up.
Yeah. Then the question becomes, you know, did nephew who's in the will decide to help out here? Well, that's a mess, Tom. Thanks for mentioning Jay Inslee, though. I had forgotten that he was your governor, and back 5 years ago or thereabouts, when he was a member of Congress, I was up in Seattle for a fundraiser for Jim McDermott, and I had dinner with Jay Inslee. I was really impressed by that guy. I hope he's a good governor for your state.
He's doing pretty well so far. He was heavily involved in that Boeing IAM negotiation.
Yeah.
And it's true.
That's still up in the air, right?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll see how that shakes out. Tom, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Steve in Haymarket, Virginia. Steve, what's on your mind?
Yes, your movie about global warming and the threat to methane.
Yeah, over at lasthours.org.
Yes. I was thinking about a fairly simple solution to it. Well, it's expensive, of course, but in essence, you would use landfill liner and, survey and find the places that are close to, coming loose or exploding, cover it with landfill liner, and then figure out a liquid gas that would be cooler than methane, and in essence, pull the methane out of the deposit.
Okay, so what we're talking about here is methane that is frozen in gaseous methane that has been frozen in crystal lattices of ice, basically, of frozen water. Methane itself doesn't freeze until it gets like 300 degrees below zero, but water will freeze at 30, 31, 32, depending on the pressure. And but when that methane turns to gas, have you ever tried to stop a gas coming out of deep water? I mean, it's awful hard.
Yeah, that's the problem right now. You'd in essence have an explosion.
Yeah.
And you've got to figure out a colder element besides methane to be able to remove it.
Right. It uses less energy than the hundreds of millions of gallons of diesel fuel it might take to power something, to cool something down like that. Interesting, Steve. This falls into the area of geoengineering. Thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And geoengineering gets real problematic. A whole lot better just not to melt that methane in the first place, which means don't warm the world any more than it is. Back. It's the good, the bad, and the very, very comically ugly. The good, the Bridgewater Badgers. The fifth graders in this Bridgewater, Massachusetts Pee-wee football team are earning praise around the country this week for how they showed support for their water boy, six-year-old Danny Keefe. Danny dressed in suits every day, and because of a brain hemorrhage he had when he was born, has a speech impediment. When his teammates found out that he was being teased for the way he dresses and talks, they decided to do something extra special. WABC covered the story for local TV. Check it out.
In the middle of it all, Danny Keefe, Bridgewater first grader, water boy for the Williams School fifth grade football team. Danny always wears a tie and jacket. He has some speech issues. A few other kids had been picking on him about that, and yesterday his team dressed up to show they don't approve.
We heard that Danny was getting picked on, so we thought that we would all have a day to dress up like Danny. And we thought we would all come to school like Danny and sponsor Danny to show Danny that we love him.
There's an old saying that kids bring out the worst in human nature, but if the Bridgewater Badgers are any indication, kids also bring out the best in all of us. Way to go, Badgers. The bad. Senator John Cornyn of Texas. The Texas senator never misses an opportunity to badmouth President Obama, but Saturday night he took his shtick a little too far. Right after the news broke that the U.S. and Iran had reached a deal over the Islamic Republic's nuclear program, Cornyn sent out the following tweet. Amazing what the White House will do to distract attention from OCARE. Right. He's trying to prevent another war in the Middle East. It's such a cynical, unnecessary political move. It's astounding what some Republicans will do to slander the White House, especially this White House. And the very, very ugly John Derbyshire. The former National Review writer is no stranger to racial controversy. I mean, the reason Derbyshire is a former National Review writer is, in the first place, is that he wrote a column about the death of Trayvon Martin that essentially told white parents to warn their children about black people. His latest piece for VDare.com may actually be worse than that offensive Trayvon Martin column. According to Derbyshire, the new movie 12 Years a Slave was abolitionist porn that portrays slavery as worse than it actually was. Never mind the fact that, you know, 12 Years a Slave is based on actual historical events. Actually, who cares about facts at all? Because, know what the worst part is? Derbyshire hasn't even seen the movie, and admits as much in the article. His column, by the way, also includes this nugget of wisdom. Slavery is more irksome to some than to others, and freedom can be irksome too. Personally, I'd be a terrible slave, too ornery. I know people, though, and I'm talking about white people, who I quietly suspect would be happy enslaved. And that is very, very ugly. That actually betrays an astounding, a breathtaking ignorance of history. There's no other way to say it. Just a breathtaking ignorance of history. Joseph in Cottage Grove, Oregon. Hey, Joseph, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, that was an interesting comment. I never thought I'd hear it on your program about alternative holidays.
Yes, yeah, secular holidays. And all that stuff.
Yes. I actually wrote a musical play on that subject and just finished it. And here's how it goes. During Thanksgiving, we extend that for 3 days and call it the season of Thanksgiving and gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone is charged to go to somebody else's house on alternate days and have this feast. And the protocol is before the meal, everybody has an opportunity to say at the table, heretofore unknown venue, everyone at the table says what they feel gratitude about.
Mm-hmm.
All the way around, and hold a glass of water up.
Mm-hmm.
And feel gratitude for the water. And now at Christmas time, we erase that, start on the 21st, and go all the way to the first of the year. And we do the season of love and gratitude.
Hmm. You're getting close to Advent here, you know.
Pardon me?
Advent is, I'm not close enough to the,
yes.
You know, but.
Right, right. You got it. But during the season of love and gratitude, you're right. You just sort of.
Well, in Thanksgiving, you know, the real roots of Thanksgiving, at least in Northern European traditions, go back long before pilgrims or North America. They go back to it was a harvest festival. It was a time when all the food had been brought in, and what had to be eaten because it didn't store well had to be eaten fairly quickly. And for Native Americans, it was a potlatch festival. You know, where the more you could give away, the more status you got in the community, and it was getting ready for the long winter festival. I mean, it was basically a harvest festival, and it did last multiple days.
The Dalai Lama said those who practice gratitude will eventually become enlightened.
I agree.
So therefore, this gratitude is such a very powerful, powerful concept. To feel heartfelt gratitude for even the smallest positive, the whole universe celebrates.
I think the two most healing emotions and that in existence, things that people should go out of their way to experience daily, are gratitude and forgiveness.
Right.
There's nothing more powerful than gratitude or forgiveness. They you know, gratitude just cranks up the internal machine, and forgiveness wipes the slate and empties us up of pain, and they are such powerful, powerful healing things. Joseph, thanks for sharing that with us. David in Chicago. Hey, David.
Hi, Tom. First and foremost, we're very grateful for your radio and TV airtime.
Thank you.
And bravos to you and Victoria and Bernie Sanders, and because you bring us such incredible enlightenment.
Thank
you. But referencing dying with dignity,
mm-hmm.
I mean, my partner John and I are on board 100%, and with one having control over their demise.
Mm-hmm.
But what about the persons like my mother who's in an Alzheimer's facility.
Yeah.
As I recall her exclaiming in the past, if I become stricken with a disability, disease, give me a pill, you know, right. Said in jest. But nonetheless, it's something that we've all typically heard through the years from a loved one, perhaps, or a friend. But which brings on this current angst that she could easily live out her money.
Right.
And I view all this dilemma as collective corralled commodities for these facilities. I mean, it's sure. Literally a game of chess.
Yep. They've turned us into commodities. And you know, I've said to Louise and she to me, you know, if we ever become, my mother died of Alzheimer's. And, you know, yeah. If I ever get that far gone, please put me out of my misery. But, you know, the downside of that is in today's America, if she were to do that, she would be probably prosecuted for murder. And, you know, I would not want that to happen to my wife. And we don't have any easy or neat or clean solutions to this, which is really, in fact, we're afraid to have the conversation. As soon as we start having the conversation, Sarah Palin pops up and starts screaming about death panels.
I know, and I just recommend for those who are in my shoes to try to attend a support group, which is extremely valuable.
Mm.
So that's it.
Does your partner have? Oh, your mother has Alzheimer's.
My mother, yeah. As my my partner John's mother passed away due to the effects of Alzheimer's.
It's a tough one. It's a very, very tough one, and we're not handling it well as a culture, and our healthcare system doesn't handle it well, and frankly, our legal system doesn't even handle it well. These not dead, not in excruciating pain, but just not there anymore kinds of conditions. David, thank you for the call. You wanted to make an additional point?
We applaud you. Continued success.
Okay. Thank you, David. And my very best to your partner as well. Thank you for your kind words. Brian in Denver, listening on AM 760. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Hi. I heard you talking a little bit about the holidays, and I did my best to catch up because that's when I began listening.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that was a guest and not a caller.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Or both.
Yeah. He's the author of a new book.
All righty. What I've had difficulty tracking, because we recently had something, an incident in Colorado. Not real thick on the details of that either. It was a little bit of church and state raised.
Mm-hmm.
But I got a feeling that because it was a group that identified themselves, I hope it's right. I got lost between the terms atheist and the terms humanist.
Mm-hmm.
One of the concerns that I had is it sounds like there was something trying to be a thing while talking about the law.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't understand what the thing was supposed to be with the group that was talking and mentioned.
Yeah.
There's a very nice humanist point of view to doing nice things.
Sure.
My concern was that this sounded like to have freedom and state coincide.
Right.
And avoid the stripping out. It was a case against private schools. Because otherwise, how can you even schedule the day the kids will be in school? Thursday?
Right. Yeah. Thursday. There you go. You raise an interesting question, Brian. Thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I think the net of it is that we really don't understand the history of most of our holidays, A, and B, that secular people should be able to have holidays. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's see here. Jeff in Rogers, Arkansas, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind?
Hey, how are you doing today, Tom?
Great. What's up?
Well, I heard that libertarian guy talking about the railroad system wouldn't work for passengers, but I don't see why they just couldn't take the interstate system that we have and use it as a template for it. And people that live in areas that are, you know, not overpopulated would have an advantage of being able to ride a high-speed train to a job or something.
It makes perfect sense to me. I think that we need much more mass transit in the United States. And, in fact, that was originally part of President Obama's stimulus suggestion. But the Republicans would have nothing to do with it because, you know, it would make America better, of course. So,
well, you know, you would have like a New Deal job here, 50 states to take and build it. The auto industries could take and build the chassis. The aircraft industry could build the coaches.
Sure. Sure. Well, look what we did with the interstate highway system. I mean, you know, FDR just basically laid the roads, and it was like, if you build it, they will come. It transformed America. It even transformed the way that we do our holidays. So it's a fascinating thing.
Know, everything could work off of, because you already have loops around cities that could divert freight.
Yeah.
And then you could have, like, the public bus system taking up the slack, and maybe the light rail system. And then automakers could just maybe make cars that are like Mr. Potato Head, you know? The outside is a superficial part. So every year they could just change the outside of the car.
Sort of like the smart cars. Yeah. Okay, good one. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Patricia in Ettrick, Wisconsin, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Patricia, you wanted to talk about pain medications? Patricia, you are on the air. Oh, my. Patricia's watching TV instead of listening to her telephone. Tony in East Hampton, Mass. Tony, what's up?
Hi. Nice to talk to you. And thank you for all the good work you do. Thank I just you. Wanted to bring you up to date on the Massachusetts thinking on death with dignity. Last year, 2012, we had two referenda on the ballot.
Mm-hmm.
One was for medical marijuana and one was for death with dignity. Medical marijuana passed, and we're about to get our first dispensaries early in next year, I hope.
Great.
And, I mean, I hope early we're getting them next year. And the other was death with dignity, which did not pass.
Hmm.
But hopefully that has started the discussion, and we will be getting that within the next few years. I'm hoping it'll come up again, and we'll pass next time. So just thought you'd like to know, although my plan is to move to Oregon when I get to that stage of my life, just to be covered.
Yeah, it's almost worth it, you know. I mean, when you consider the awful, painful deaths that some people go through.
It's terrible, and to be able to make that choice for yourself and to have your family and friends and all your loved ones with you, and
yeah.
And it probably takes a great deal of courage to do that.
I think so. Tony, thank you so much for the call, and thanks for the update on what's going on in Massachusetts. I appreciate it. We'll be right back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you on your media support group for We the People, the Tom Hartman program. Rob in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Rob, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Sure.
I was calling. I hope I'm not stealing some thunder from your guest who wrote the book on Thanksgiving. But I was reading a book today. It was very fascinating. It was published back in 1895. The author's name is W. DeLoss Love, Jr., and it goes through the history of Thanksgiving, among other things. And one of the things that it said was that in 1777, the Continental Congress declared a day of Thanksgiving, and Washington's troops were in Valley Forge at the time. And I believe the date was in December of that year. So that was maybe the first American Thanksgiving as America.
Oh, that's
interesting. And then there was a second. It was very fascinating. There's a lot in there that's interesting stuff. But there's one more thing about in 1863, Lincoln proclaimed a day of Thanksgiving after Gettysburg, and that was celebrated in October, I think it was, or maybe earlier.
It was Lincoln who established that third Thursday thing.
Well, that was the second. Yes, that's true. But that was the second Thanksgiving in 1863. The first one was for the northern states in celebration of Gettysburg.
I see.
Then he did a second one. He proclaimed in October. He went to Gettysburg. He gave the Gettysburg Address, and then the first national Thanksgiving happened in a week later in November of 1863. So if you can get your hands on the book, it's really interesting stuff. So
Rob, you are a font of trivia. Thank you. Thank you very much. It's great having listeners who know more than you do. I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Jerry in Kansas City, Missouri, you wanted to talk about the crash of 2016, maybe? Jerry? No, Jerry. Patricia in Ettrick, Wisconsin. Hey, Patricia, you wanted to talk about pain medication?
Yes. I wanted to tell you my husband thinks I'm having an affair with you, but I tell him I'm having an affair with your brain and your wife can have the rest.
We're a little far away from each other in any case.
Yeah.
So what's up,
Patricia? Well, I like your thinking. But anyway, about the pain medication, I have a license to practice AODA and behavioral counseling.
Uh-huh.
So I don't do it anymore, but I keep up with it. But most, you know, these doctors prescribing pain medication has gotten ridiculous. Mm. You have to, if you can get anything, you have to take a urine test. And in Consumers Reports, they said, this is a scam, a money-making scam.
Oh, you know, I can tell you that. Back in the 70s, I had a friend who was a chemist who came up with a urine test, just a test to measure the strength of your drugs, and he was selling it in High Times magazine. And it's like 15 cents worth of chemicals. He was selling it for 10, 15 bucks. He ultimately sold his company for millions and millions of dollars to one of the big drug companies. But these drug tests, they charge you 35, 50 bucks a whack. It's 15 cents worth of chemicals.
Or $80 we got charged
for
my husband takes pain medication, and they tested him for cocaine, meth. My husband is 72, by the way.
Give me
cocaine, meth, every illegal drug you can imagine, everything else.
Yeah.
Because he takes this narcotic pain, he has chronic pain.
Right.
But anyway, here's the thing. Oh, they're worried about all these pain pills on the streets. Oh, my God. Most of these pain pills come from Broward County, Florida.
Yep.
Where they have pain clinics all over the place, and they're 100% legal. And the doctors down there have, it's $500. You go in and that pays for the doctor's call, an x-ray, and they're the pharmacy, and they own this.
Right.
The doctors.
Right.
They own all.
I've heard that, and I've heard that there's no coincidence that Rush Limbaugh was nearby that, you know, might have contributed to his problem.
I think probably, and they come down nearby the van loads. And
wow.
You go in there, you get this, all this done, doctors call, x-ray, you know, pharmacy
mm-hmm.
thing. For about $500, and these doctors will start out in some crappy little clinic, and in about 3-4 years, they've got one swell clinic in a nice mall that looks terrific, and they make between $4 and $5 million a year each doctor. So now
that's abusive system.
They're not going to do anything about it because look at the taxes they make off.
Yeah, and then they overprescribe this stuff, and then people go out and sell them on the streets or whatever, and you know that's amazing. Patricia, thank you for sharing that. I think Jerry in Kansas City, Missouri. You want to try it again, Jerry?
Yeah, do you hear me okay?
Sure. We got a minute to the end of the show today. What's up?
Okay. Yeah, I bought your book. Started reading The Crash of 2016. Personally, I find that both sides, Republican, Democrats, they kind of fight back and forth on certain things. But when it comes to the economy, they're definitely in lockstep. And when it comes to things like the Federal Reserve or the International Bank of Settlements, which is really privately owned by a small group of people, why can't we as citizens ever talk about it? That's the most important impediment to our success as a nation.
Yeah, I don't disagree. If you go over to Financial Times, you may have to subscribe, but on the front page of the Financial Times, I was watching it this morning, there's a little six-minute video about how they were talking about the difference between price-earnings ratio and stock prices, and the guy said, we're seeing a little froth here like we saw back in 2008. And I'm going, oh, no. You know, so anyhow. Jerry, thanks a lot for the call. You're right. We need a lot more transparency in our banking system. That's what Elizabeth Warren is all about. Coming up tomorrow, all the news and information you're not going to hear in the corporate-owned news media. Plus, what happens if China stops buying U.S. debt? Frankly, I don't think it's a big deal at all. Challenge Libertarian financial advisor Peter Schiff, who seems really hysterical about it. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It begins with you. You got to get out there, get active, and occupy something. Tag your it. And quick heads up, lasthours.org and crash of 2016. I think you'll find some value there. Thanks a lot for listening and watching. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.